Welcome to the Modern Art Notes podcast. I'm Tyler Green. A few weeks ago, I was looking for something all-American to feature during 4th of July week, and I think I found it. A new show at New York's Apex Art that examines the continuing impact the 19th century railroad building boom has had on the way American artists look at the landscape. The exhibition, titled The Permanent Way, is on view at Apex Art through July 28th. A little later on, I'll be joined by Mark Riddell, who will tell us about his Westward the Course of Empire series, a body of work that took him to the remnants of over 100 railroad lines. But first, I'll talk with Brian Scholes, who curated The Permanent Way. Scholes is a New York-based writer, editor, and a PhD candidate at the City University of New York. He is the co-editor of The Uncertain States of America Reader, a 2006 anthology of writing on contemporary art and politics. He contributes to Art Forum, where he was previously an editor, and to magazines such as Aperture, Art in America, Book Forum, and Frieze. I'll be back with Brian Scholes after a break. The acclaimed exhibition Lucian Freud Portraits opens July 1st at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth, the show's only United States venue. Widely considered the greatest portrait painter of the 20th century, Freud's visceral renderings of people from all walks of life have a painterly and psychological drama that is unparalleled in contemporary art. His subjects range from neighbors, friends, lovers, family, art world personalities, to royalty. For much of a century, from the late 1940s until his recent death in July 2011, Freud made the living human presence his subject. Lucian Freud Portraits at the Modern, July 1st through October 28th. Visit themodern.org for more information. The Museum of Fine Arts Houston. Now on view, Rembrandt, Van Dyck, Gainsborough, the treasures of Kenwood House, London. Catch a glimpse of some of England's greatest art treasures, including one of Rembrandt's most iconic self-portraits and stunning full-length paintings of 18th century society beauties. This superb exhibition is making its U.S. debut at the MFAH. For more information on the Museum of Fine Arts Houston and the Treasures of Kenwood House exhibition, please visit mfah.org. And we're back. Brian Scholes, welcome to the Modern Art Notes podcast.
Thank you.
Your new show at New York's Apex Art commemorates the 150th anniversary of the Pacific Railway Act. I think probably a good place to start would be to find out what that legislation did.
That was the first of a couple of pieces of legislation. It was passed, obviously, on July 1st of 1862 during the Civil War, and it was legislation that essentially paved the way for private companies, two of them in particular, to create what was considered to be the first transcontinental railroad. That railroad was completed in 1869, so it took the rest of the decade for it to work. But the federal government, Congress, created land grants that gave the companies the right to sell or do what they needed to do with regard to some land in the unpopulated, supposedly unpopulated American West, not just the right of way for the railroads themselves, but also several miles of land to either side, which they could then dispose of with as they wish, gave them some money and generally just sort of created the conditions and paved the way for what was a seemingly improbable and fiscally impossible. No company was large enough at the time to actually undertake the task. Gave them a chance to do it.
Your story starts in 1862, and you have a map from the U.S. Census Office from 1890, so many years later, that shows what happened and how the railroads, which were at the time densely congregated around the upper Midwest, the Great Lakes, and the Northeast, how they moved west. And it's a pretty dramatic map.
It's true. I should maybe say that the exhibition itself combines contemporary landscape photographs that somehow depict or embrace railroads or the decaying infrastructure of what once were railroads in mostly the American West, although there are some photographs from upstate New York. So contemporary photographs that were taken in recent decades alongside 19th century archival material. And the map that you're referring to is actually the latest of three maps that are in the show. I chose one from 1859, just before the legislation was passed, one from 1875, which is just after a huge boom in railroad construction that commenced with the end of the Civil War and lasted until about 1871 or 1872, and then one from the end of the century, just to show, again, the growth and the rapid spread of the railroads. That first map from 1859, in fact, only shows the eastern half of the United States because the Mississippi River acted as a kind of natural barrier for the expansion of railroads up until the late 1850s and the early 1860s. And then once the Mississippi had been crossed with railroad bridges, in a way, it was off to the races, and the legislation was the firing gun, in a way, that started the race across the continent. You can see in each of these three maps that are in the exhibition that they plot not only the railroads that then currently exist, but also the projected railroads. And many of the projected ones never came to fruition, but they do give a sense of how ambitious were the men who were responsible for building these tracks across the what was then the wilderness.
There are images of all three of those maps on Apex Art's website. We'll have links to that on Modern Art Notes and on manpodcast.com. As you note in your essay, Western railroad companies in particular, but the Eastern-based ones as well, recognized almost immediately the imperative of showing Western lands to Easterners, of suggesting that West was some place that people consider going. You mentioned the postcards in your show. Could you maybe detail how the railroads were fundamentally and necessarily involved in showing Western lands to Easterners?
When these railroad companies were granted all of this excess land, in addition to the land on which they were actually going to put these narrow tracks, they had to do something with it. They had to sell it in order to make more money in order to build the tracks themselves. It was a very expensive undertaking. And one way to sell these lands that nobody had seen was, of course, to somehow visualize for people who were living in the East or even people who were living in Europe what life in the West might be like. And photography was very central to that process. If you go into, you know, the New York Public Library, as I did, or to any good library in the United States and ask for, you know, 19th century printed material advertising the American West, there is tons of it. There are publicity brochures. There are little books from all different kinds of towns that have just sprung up along the rail lines. There are maps and timetables that have fanciful images around their borders. All kinds of material were printed by the railroad companies themselves and sometimes by sort of municipal authorities in these places that were created around the railroad depots.
Or by the railroad.
Indeed. There's a landscape writer named John Brinkerhoff Jackson, who wrote a great book called American Space that talks about developments between 1865 and 1875. And he talks about how town planning, urban planning, such as it was during this time period, especially in the Midwest and the West, is a product of people who are on the payroll of railroad companies. Mm-hmm. Look, though there may no longer be a track down Main Street, the grid of whatever small town in, you know, Illinois or Nebraska, it's perfectly parallel. If you look one side of the Main Street and the other, the streets are the same. And so the railroads had a very, very important role in both shaping a habitable version of the American West and then trying to entice people to actually inhabit it. The postcards themselves that are included in this show are from the early 20th century. It's a photographic technology called real photo postcards. And it was something that was turned on to me, or rather that I became aware of through Luke Sant, who the writer and curator, who has collected a number of these and published a book about them. In about 1903 or 1904, this new printing technology was invented and distributed widely, in which people would put a postcard size negative, it was a paper-backed negative, into a camera and take a unique photograph, but it was printed not on photo paper, or it was actually printed on postcard paper. And so you would print it out, it would develop, and then you'd write a little note on the back and send it to someone. And he has a number of these in his collection, and I've borrowed many of them that picked trains or railroad tracks for the exhibition. And it's an attempt to show people who come to visit the exhibition, just how ubiquitous by the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century railroads were in American life. So it's not just pictures of tracks running through an empty landscape. It's also wrecks, because train wrecks were commonplace. It's also images from expositions where there's novelty trains, you know, festooned with oranges, for example, the bounty of the American, you know, of California's orange groves, or scenes where people are posing with each other as if they're standing on the back of a train viewing platform, just a cardboard cutout. So railroads at first, when the technology was first introduced in the 1840s is when it sort of first becomes widespread, people react somewhat of horror. But by the middle of the century, and by the time the Pacific Railway Act itself is passed in 1862, there's no fighting it any longer. And they've become an accepted and an almost naturalized part of American life. And to a certain extent, one of the arguments of the show, if it can be said to have an argument, is that trains themselves have become a kind of naturalized part of the American landscape.
One of the things we should probably mention to set up the five contemporary artists we'll be talking about in a minute is that for the railroads, it was critically important to encourage people to move west, not just to sell the land, but also to farm the land or to cut down timber around the land, because that, of course, is the freight that the railroad would base the next many decades of revenue on.
Right.
So when we see the orange train in this fantastic 1910 postcard, part of what the railroad is doing is showing to an Eastern audience how easy it is, nudge, nudge, to grow things in the West, and how there's also a market for it there back there in the East.
It's true. They needed not only to sell the land that they had been granted by the federal government, but also to get people onto it quickly so that they aren't running empty trains. Every empty rail car was money lost to them, and they needed to fill those trains up as quickly as possible.
So toward this end, the railroads hired photographers, men like Charles Savage or Andrew Russell, men who had started as photographers during the Civil War and then moved west. While their work isn't in your show, their work is absolutely behind your show. Seeing the five artists in your show, one is reminded how richly the photographers in your show are informed by earlier landscape photography. Could you, I guess, introduce the five artists who are in the show?
I'd be happy to. And yes, I agree 100% that the photographers that are included in my show, all of whom are living now and all of whom made their photographs within the last two decades, are incredibly well-versed in the photographic history of depicting the American landscape. And you can see echoes of those images that are from the 19th century in the 20th and 21st century photographs that I've included. Mm-hmm. I put a pretty bright dividing line between the two. I didn't want to include any archival 19th century photographs in the show. I didn't want to sort of mix my messages a little bit. So all of the 19th century material that you'll find, all of the older stuff, is non-photographic. There are lithographic prints, and those, some of them were based on photographs, but there are no actual sort of mounted and framed photographs from the 19th century. Instead, the five photographs I've chosen, or the five photographers that I've chosen to include in the show, are Jeff Bruce, Mark Ruedel, James Welling, Justine Kurland, and Victoria Sambuneras. Now, I've been working for about a decade as a reviewer of art exhibitions, and I was an editor at Artform magazine for a while. And in the last two or three years, I've become increasingly interested in photography, and in particular in landscape photography. So all five of these photographers were people whose work I've been familiar with, and the individual photographs that are in my show, I have actually seen many of them in other exhibitions recently. It all sort of stuck out to me. I've written about several of these artists. And I had sort of always wanted to work on bringing them together and also putting them in a slightly different context, perhaps by way of giving your listeners context. I not only was an editor at Art Forum, but am now pursuing a PhD in American history at the City University of New York's Graduate Center. And I had seen and understood these photographs the first time I saw them, before I had sort of fully ensconced myself in an academic environment, within the realm of art history, within the realm of photographic history, within the realm of other contemporary photographs that I'm seeing at galleries in Chelsea, at museums in and around New York. Now, armed with a little bit more knowledge about the 19th century and about the development of the railroads themselves, I hope to resituate these contemporary photographers in the context of that broader social, political, economic, and cultural American history. To just give you a couple of samples of what is included in the show, Jeff Bruce, for example, has three photographs from a series of images that he took near his house in upstate New York that all depict now abandoned rights of way. He was walking around near his house upstate several years ago and began to notice these paths that were cut through the forest where there would be trees, but no actual road there. And he couldn't quite figure out what they were used for. But a little bit of research turned up that indeed there was a very active railroad infrastructure that would bring agricultural products, and in particular dairy products, from farms upstate New York down to the city. And so he made a point of revisiting 19th century maps, locating these former rights of way for the trains, and going and photographing beautiful, lovely images that show these abandoned paths sort of receding into the distance, into a sort of central vanishing point. There was a large series of them that were exhibited in New York in late 2011, and I've pulled several of them for my show here at Apex Art.
To go back to the comparison you were making between the five artists in the show and 19th century work, one of the things that jumps out to me is how few of the pictures here could have been taken in the 19th century, because I guess principally because there are trains moving through them, and the technology in the 19th century would have just left those as a blur. And I'm wondering if that's something that you thought about as you were selecting the show.
Well, that's certainly the case. It's interesting because I was concerned, or remain concerned, even because the show is still on view, that people who are train spotters, who are really interested in trains and railroad infrastructure themselves in particular, would come to the show and be somewhat disappointed, because I actually envisioned a landscape photo show. It's one that happens to include trains, but many of the photographs themselves, as with the Jeff Bruce photographs that I was just describing, don't actually depict any trains, or in some cases don't depict even rails. It's just sort of paths or places where that infrastructure had been and where that industry had made its mark on the American landscape. But for me, this is very much a landscape show primarily, and then sort of a train show secondarily. So I did think about sort of technology, the changing technologies, not only of the photographic apparatus, you know, the cameras that are taking these pictures and the trains that are moving through the spaces, but some of the photos too are very much about demonstrating how trains themselves are part of a broader human incursion upon the land. And Victoria Sambudneris's photographs in particular, I think, do a good job of this. There's one photo of a place called Wendover, Utah, that was taken in 2007 that's included in the show, which the train itself is a very, very tiny, tiny aspect of a very beautiful and large photograph that depicts a small town that's sort of resting in the bowl in between two mountain ranges. She's taking it from a very high, sort of elevated vantage point, with a little town in the middle distance and then a train trailing even further back towards the mountains that are at the very, very rear of the picture. And in the foreground of that photo, if you look very closely, you can see that the only store in this town that you can sort of read the sign of happens to be a film and video rental store. And this whole photograph has this sort of cinematic air. It's this beautiful, expansive picture of the landscape, sort of commenting on that sign in her final image. Another photo of hers depicts the U.S.-Mexico border in Sunland Park, New Mexico. And it's from a series of photographs that she's still working on that describe the U.S.-Mexico border in many different ways. But what's interesting about that photograph is not only that there's a train going through it, but that train itself was the site of a kind of political and economic conflict or controversy, if you will. It literally passes within feet of the fence that divides the two countries. And apparently in the late 1990s, what, for lack of a better term, I'll call Mexican bandits, would throw debris onto the tracks to force the trains to stop because they couldn't pass. And when the trains were stopped, armed men would unload cargo from the trains and spirit it across the border into Mexico. They were stealing from the railroad companies and from the companies that, you know, shipped their goods along this route. The FBI actually set up a sting operation to try and stop this and catch the people who were doing it, which went awry. This is in about 2000, and two FBI agents were actually beat and I think put into the hospital, and it was sort of a very dramatic, newsworthy story. And it continues to this day. There are apparently still issues with lost cargo and problems with this train route that runs through what otherwise looks to be a sort of very beautiful and benign landscape. And those kinds of issues and the stories of multiple uses of given places and how trains are part of a much broader sort of human use of the landscape are what's most interesting to me about the photographs in this show.
Brian Scholes is my guest on this week's Modern Art Notes podcast. We're talking about his new show at Apex Art in New York. It's titled The Permanent Way. We'll be right back after a break.
Now on view at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art in Fort Worth, American Vanguards, Graham, Davis, Gorky, de Kooning, and Their Circle, 1927 to 1942. This exhibition features numerous works by the artists who were critical in defining American modernism, John Graham, Stuart Davis, Arshel Gorky, Willem de Kooning, and Jackson Pollock. On view through August 19. More information at cartermuseum.org.
In celebration of its 10th anniversary year, the Pulitzer Foundation for the Arts in St. Louis presents the exhibition In the Still Epiphany. New York-based artist Getty Siboney is creating a large-scale temporary work of art comprised of nearly 50 objects from the collection of Emily and Joseph Pulitzer, Jr., including works by John Singer Sargent, Pablo Picasso, Henri Matisse, Pierre Bonnard, and more. Siboney is known for creating subtly poetic installations that establish a resonance between objects and the space they inhabit. The exhibition is on view from April 5th to October 27th. For more information, go to pulitzerarts.org. I hope you're enjoying this week's show. Remember, you can subscribe to the Modern Art Notes podcast on iTunes. Just search for Modern Art Notes Podcast via RSS feed at manpodcast.com, or you can listen to a stream at Modern Art Notes, where you can also find images of most of the artworks discussed on this week's program. If you're enjoying the show, please tell a friend. Now back to the program. And we're back with Brian Scholes on this week's Modern Art Notes podcast. You were just discussing a couple pictures by Victoria Sambunaris. Another thing I thought about as I looked at the pictures in this show is, while it's a show very much about landscape, and I want to get to a specific example of that in a minute, it's also a show about engineering and kind of the history of the way American artists have showed how the landscape has been engineered. And there's a Justine Kerlin picture, Three Riders, UP Mixed Freight, that shows a big, broad turn in the road. And maybe you could tell us about that picture and maybe make a connection between it and a particular postcard in your show.
Well, that photograph by Justine Kerlin, Three Riders, UP Mixed Freight, is actually brand new. She printed it for the exhibition, Very generous offer. And what's interesting is that in order to make a landscape show, I've had to, as any curator does, had to sort of slightly repurpose photographs that had a different authorial intent. Or, you know, she had a specific idea of what she was taking a photograph of, and I've rejiggered it to fit into my puzzle. So her whole photographic series that I'm drawing photographs from has as much to do or more to do with hobos and people who ride the rails, so to speak, as it does with landscapes or the trains themselves or the engineering marvels that created, you know, created this possibility for trains to move through this landscape. And so the three riders are, in fact, a tiny little detail that you can see in the open car doors in the foreground of the train that's moving through this bend. And that's something that she's interested in, sort of socially marginalized subcultures and how they interact with each other, then also to a certain extent how they interact with the environment. I myself, as a curator of this show, was less interested in those people than about how this fits into broader structures or broader visual motifs, I guess you could say. And you had mentioned there was a postcard, and I suspect that the one you're referring to is depicting the famous horseshoe curve on the main line of the Pennsylvania Railroad, a postcard from 1910, not a real photo postcard in the same technology as the ones that I was describing earlier, but it shows one of the technological feats that was necessary in order to move these trains through the landscape. The main line Pennsylvania Railroad, the horseshoe curve goes around a body of water, and it's sort of this. It creates a sort of dramatic inflection point, I guess you could say, quite literally so, that lends itself to being photographed. You can see hills on either side and water stretching away into the distance between them. And it almost seems meant to be a picture, although in fact it was almost just solving an engineering problem that created this horseshoe curve.
There's a long history of railroad photographers in the 19th century, both photographers like Russell and Savage, who were hired by the railroad, but also Carlton Watkins, who didn't work for the railroad as directly as they did, showing off the engineering and technological achievements of their employers or of the railroads. You know, a very famous example is Carlton Watkins' pictures of the loop built by the Southern Pacific to cross the Tehachapi Mountains, where the San Joaquin Valley meets the Mojave Desert, or would meet the Mojave Desert if the mountains weren't there. And Watkins took a series of photographs of the loop in the 1880s, in which he underscored the engineering achievement by etching directly on the negative with a pen or a metal stick of some type to underscore the drama of the engineering achievement. And I thought of that when I saw Curlin's picture, even her picture going through the Donner Pass, which is like you point out, not directly an engineering picture, but also when I saw Jim Welling's pictures, his picture of Hagerstown, Maryland from 1991, which looks up admiringly at a CSX locomotive, is full of admiration for the feat, if you will.
Yeah, it's true. And the show itself is called The Permanent Way, which is a term that is used to describe path in a sense, but also the infrastructure of the path that the trains move along. And so that photograph in particular, looking up at the CSX engine, you can see that indeed it's from it is raised above the vantage point of where James Welling was standing to take the picture. The Permanent Way itself encompasses the rise, oftentimes stone or earth that's been raised, the ties themselves, the rails, etc. So from top to bottom, the Permanent Way is what's the name that's given to sort of the entire infrastructure that makes railroad transport possible. And those three photographs by James Welling that are included in the show are the ones that are perhaps going to be the most satisfying to train spotters. They most closely depict the actual infrastructure and the engines and the railroads, the trains themselves, of all the ones in the show.
You mentioned Jeff Bruce earlier. His pictures really show the permanence of the way, in the sense that they riff on that classic railroad photography vanishing point perspective picture, where the photographer puts his camera on a couple of railroad ties, and then looks down the rails as the rails vanish into the center of the picture. And Bruce's pictures demonstrate just how permanent that way was, how 100 years later, the railroad has still left its mark on upstate New York by where trees do or don't grow, or a road that is still somewhat slightly there.
It's true. And there's a wonderful landscape book written by a landscape writer named John Stilgo, who's based at Harvard University. And he wrote a book in the early 1980s called The Metropolitan Corridor, which is his name for all the apparatus that attends these trains themselves. So he talks about the tracks and the environmental changes that they wrought. He talks about stations. He talks about the landscape and the gardens that were put around the stations. It's almost a cultural history of this new architectural and landscape environment created by the need to move freight with locomotives across the country. And it's laden with pictures, and it's a really, really well-written book. And so if you're interested more in these types of issues, that's one place that I would look beyond the exhibition itself.
One of the interesting things about your show is that it, as best I can tell, is absolutely absent of sentimentality. There is no kind of, either curatorially or from the artists themselves, no kind of romance of the Old West, romance of what was made. That's just not there. And I wonder if that's something that you thought about or sought to avoid as you put the show together.
In a way, you're recognizing that I didn't think about it, and that my not thinking about it is indicative of the tone or the atmosphere that you've, you know, identified. I don't have some sort of dramatic attraction to the American Western landscape. I grew up in Chicago and have lived in Boston and New York City since then. So what yearnings I have for non-urban places can be satisfied, and at least they have been to this point in my life, have been satisfied by fantasies about Maine or other places as much as the American West. I like the photographs aesthetically. I enjoy looking at them. I enjoy thinking about what it is that they mean. But in terms of having a romantic attraction to these landscapes or to the idea of train travel itself, that's not something that's ever come through in my own life, independent of curatorial work or critical writing or anything like that. And so it didn't come through, I guess, when it came time to organize a show around this theme. For me, aesthetically, these are photographs that I was attracted to, and intellectually, you know, the 150th anniversary of the Pacific Railway Act just presented for me an opportunity to bring together the two aspects of my life, sort of writing about contemporary art and studying the American past in one room. And it was largely an intellectual exercise, but hopefully one that's not devoid of visual interest for it or because of that.
You mentioned Trainspotting earlier. Have you been to any of the places in the pictures in your show?
I have not, as a matter
of fact. Oh, wow.
No, I've been to some of the places that Victoria Sambineras has photographed in her series, mm-hmm. The Border.
Mm-hmm.
When I was younger, I spent some years in Texas and made trips to Big Bend National Park and have swum across the Rio Grande River, as a matter of fact, making myself a temporary illegal alien on the Mexican shore. But I have not made a pilgrimage, so to speak, to even the places that are just a few hours north of New York City that Jeff himself photographs. It hasn't happened yet, no. That doesn't mean I wouldn't want to. In fact, the image that I chose to put on the postcard and I chose to use to illustrate the review I wrote when I saw an earlier exhibition of Mark Rudell's work is San Diego and Eastern Number 7. It's a photograph from 2003 of a beautiful, beautiful trestle bridge. We're speaking about sort of engineering marvels.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, spanning a valley along the side of what appears to be a mountain. That would be the first place I would go if somebody had mm-hmm. extra curatorial budget to travel to any of the places that have been included in these photographs. Rudell himself refers to that photograph as his Corbeil image, which is a little bit of a sort of. You'll see what I mean.
Yes.
But what's funny is that literally the day the show opened, someone who is not a photography buff and not a railroad buff came in and said, "Hey, that looks like the Corbeil." So he is right in jokingly referring to it as such, and someone else has caught it.
I will never be able to look at that picture again without thinking of exactly that.
No.
It's interesting to me because I have been to a lot of the places in these pictures, and take Victoria Sambinaris's picture of Wendover, for example. I've been to Wendover probably half a dozen times, maybe more. I almost don't recognize the place. I mean, I do recognize the place. There's stuff there that I've seen and I'm like, oh yes, I've been there. I've been up there. But as landscapes and as works of art, they are a useful reminder in her picture in particular that, you know, one does not have to have been to the place to inhabit the artwork. The experience of place and the experience of the artwork are two totally separate things and are in no way reliant upon each other, which I think is something, ironically, is the opposite of what the railroad companies were trying to get across in the postcards in your show. In a way, your show shows how far we've come in those 100 years from promoting the West to now being able to appreciate it absent promotion.
Mm-hmm. Well, Victoria's photographs in particular might seem or be a little bit estranging for people who are familiar with the places that she's depicting, in part because of her ability to sort of pack so much information into these prints. It's partly because of the technology that she's taking. These are large format photographs that are printed very large. In the case of the prints in my show, they're 39 by 55 inches. She always chooses almost always chooses an elevated vantage point, and there is so much detail, so much that's dropped into these images that it can seem, if not necessarily alienating, because they're very seductive as images, but nonetheless, you know, estranging for people who are familiar with Wendover from driving its streets.
And she is an information junkie. A recent exhibition of her work put together by the Terra Foundation that was at the Albright Knox in Buffalo included an entire wall of notes and diaries. So she's quite consciously trying to do
Indeed,
that.
Indeed, she missed the opening of my exhibition because she's in the midst of one of her 15 to 20,000 mile, 2 to 3 month long road trips. Now, I kept talking to her while she was in Laredo, Texas, and going back and forth between Laredo and Marfa and other places along the border to take new photographs. And, you know, she fully inhabits these places and learns as much as she can about them as she's also looking for particular vantage points from which to take her photographs.
Fantastic. Well, Brian Scholes, thanks so much for the show and for talking about it with us on the Modern Art Notes podcast.
Thank you, Tyler. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Support comes from Made in LA 2012, the first Los Angeles biennial, presented by the Hammer Museum in collaboration with LAX Art. Featuring works by 60 LA-based artists, with an emphasis on emerging and under-recognized artists, the exhibition debuts new installations, videos, films, sculptures, performances, and paintings, offering a snapshot of the current trends coming out of LA, one of the most active and energetic art scenes in the world. On view at the Hammer, LAX Art, and the Los Angeles Municipal Art Gallery. Learn more at madeinla2012.org. The Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego presents Santa Ana Condition, John Valadez, the first survey exhibition of this important Mexican-American artist who has had a profound influence on the Chicano art movement in the United States. Now on view in the museum's La Jolla campus through September 2nd, the exhibition spans 35 years of the artist's photographs, paintings, pastels, and other works on paper. For more information, visit mcasd.org. Welcome back. My next guest is a California-based photographer whose work often examines the ways in which Americans have impacted the land in the American West. His work is in the permanent collections of many major museums, including the Tate Modern, the National Gallery of Art, the Getty, SF MoMA, the Metropolitan, and more. The book related to the project discussed on this week's show, Westward: The Course of Empire, was published in 2008 by the Yale University Press. Mark Riddell, welcome to the Modern Art Notes podcast.
Thank you.
So let's kind of start from what I'm guessing is the beginning of that series. At some point, you're out in the West and the railroads catch your attention. How did you kind of come to being interested in the roads moving across the landscape?
Actually, the form of the railroad cut is what first caught my attention. But I'd been in Utah working on a much more sort of complicated project that, in fact, I've never completely resolved, called Report on Lake Bonneville, which was sort of a notion of trying to read different layers of history in the same landscape, you know, from the contemporary through historic, prehistoric, and ultimately the geological history of the land. And so I was trying to capture different aspects of historical uses of the land in that particular place. And I was in the northern side of the Great Salt Lake, which is essentially desert and mountain, which, of course, is where the first transcontinental railroad crossed the country. In fact, it's where Promontory Summit is, where the East and West railroad lines met in 1869. I hiked, the Golden Spike Monument includes, you know, a fair amount of land that's essentially preserves the ruins, if you will, of the Union Pacific and Central Pacific railroads. So I hiked some of the rail lines and made photographs, not with anything particular in mind, but when I saw the film that fall, I was really struck with the cut pictures, standing inside these rock cuts. And I think for two or three reasons. One was that I had previously been photographing the earthwork sculptures of the late 60s, early 70s, some notion about a contemporary ruin. And so my photographs of the cuts reminded me very much of standing inside a Michael Heiser's double negative in Nevada. And that sort of excited me because, you know, that made me start thinking about the railroad, the enterprise, the technology of the railroad as a kind of earthworking enterprise, one which ultimately made me think something about the relationship of capitalism and geography, and something that in Chairman Mao's book about mountains and mountaineers, which I no longer remember how that goes. But, and so I thought of the cut as a kind of emblematic of this very complex machine that sort of, you know, moved across the country from the east to the west coast, maybe a kind of symbol of imperialism and economic greed and all those other great forces at work. So, by chance, I was speaking to a park ranger in Death Valley the following year, and I mentioned these railroad cuts, and he told me about a canyon I can't remember if it's in Nevada or California at that point, right on the, more or less on the border where the Tonopah Tidewater Railroad had cut through these beautiful cuts along the Amargosa River. So I walked that, and then I love both the kind of drama of the cut, but also the name of the railroad, Tonopah Tidewater. And so I started devising this project wherein I would, you know, photograph these cuts, which in some sense are all the same, but at least the way I photograph them. But of course they're all different too, slope, type of rock, light, everything else. But also I got more and more interested in the name. So as the work progressed, I attempted to, you know, corral as many different railroads as possible. And of course, I was a bit naive. There's thousands, you know. When I finally forced myself to stop making these pictures, I had photographed, I have no idea how many pictures, but 131 different railroad lines. And originally, I was just photographing the rock cuts, and I had this notion of a kind of the technology of the railroad is a kind of engine of geological change, and also I was certainly influenced by the typologies of the Beschers. And my heroes when I was a grad student were, you know, Bob Adams and Lewis Baltz and that. So all that stuff sort of, in a very complicated way over several years, came together for me. And then I, after a few years of doing this, I came upon a stereo card, and I think it's by Russell, but it's just this, guy standing next to a railroad grade that, you know, vanishes into infinity, and there's no sort of incident in a landscape at all. It's just this line of railroad ties. I don't believe the rails are even listed, but the title of the picture was some variation on, you know, Westward, the Course of Empire Makes Its Way, or Westward, Monarch, Capitalist Makes Its Way, because these things reappear in different 19th century artworks, these titles and so on. But anyway, I looked at this incredibly dumb little banal picture, and I thought, I want to make pictures like that. So I started going to the same places again and photographing all the kind of the flat grades that I had previously walked or driven over to look for cuts and that.
By Russell, we're talking about Andrew J. Russell, who was the official photographer for the eastern half of the Union Pacific Railroad, working toward Promontory Point.
From Omaha. So I started looking at all those 19th century. I mean, I'd already been terribly excited about 19th century landscape photography, but I started looking more carefully at a lot of the railroad pictures and just thinking about, I had no intention of attempting to be a 19th century photographer, but I was interested in kind of echoing that because, of course, they're making these pictures sort of at the beginning of the age of railroads, and I'm making my pictures more or less at the end of it.
You know, one of the interesting things about that point is that most of the 19th century photographers who took pictures of the railroad and its impact on the West were either paid by or assisted by or in some other way, such as with Carlton Watkins, in the orbit of the railroads themselves. Watkins was close to Collis Huntington, one of the big four.
Mm-hmm.
As you approached your project, did you want to show a less corporate-motivated or enabled view of the land than the early prototypical American corporations did, or did you kind of notice some of that later?
You know, I think Russell, Watkins, everybody, they were, you know, they all had similar but distinct interests in that propelled them to make certain kinds of pictures. And but I think something that they share in some ways is kind of idea, like the they're looking for the best general view or something unique. You know, this is the beginnings of Western tourism. The railroads are ultimately want to promote, you know, sites and so on to encourage traffic on their lines, you know, for fun and profit, as they say. And I think, you know, maybe that's one place where I diverged from those earlier models, in that I was interested in something that was maybe less, maybe viewers would disagree with this, but I wasn't so interested in the spectacular. I was interested in a way, the repeatability. I mean, it was really important to me. Fairly early on, I understood that the work was really about amassing a certain number of pictures to suggest the scale of the enterprise. You know, you look at rare maps of railroads, and they're like spider webs across the continent. So I was really interested in and that's where the names of the railroad lines come into play as well. It sort of suggests something of the scope of this grand enterprise. It was sort of nuts. And, you know, a lot of railroads, I did photograph like Union Pacific, Central Pacific, Southern Pacific, you know, details of aspects of their lines. But I was most excited about these short, obscure mining and lumber related railroads that some of them only went 5 miles, and they were
like Kettle Valley.
Kettle Valley is that's very particular. The Kettle Valley, apparently per mile, the most expensive railroad ever built anywhere in the world. It goes through British Columbia. It connects the interior of British Columbia with, which was a heavy, significant mining district, ultimately with the Port of Vancouver via the Fraser River and the main line of the Canadian Pacific. In 300 miles, it crosses something like three complete mountain chains, you know? It's like, to describe it, I always fall back on the metaphor of Fitzcarraldo, you know? And it was so expensive to keep open, but previous to completing that railroad, the mineral wealth of the interior had to go south into the state of Washington and then out to the ports of either Seattle or Portland. And so Canadian nationalists were very unhappy with that. And I believe that the funding of the Kettle Valley Railroad had something to do with negotiations between British Columbia and the then government of Canada, because British Columbia. So again, it's a different kind of story, but it also, like the Union Pacific, has a lot to do with nation building. And I think, you know, I didn't think about all this stuff when I began, but I think that that particular idea is really an interesting thing to consider in relationship to the West and what our nation is now, in that, you know, the railroads in the 19th century in Europe, essentially, they connected existing places, whereas, you know, the railroads of the United States and Canada sort of made places.
Created them on the fly.
On the fly, yeah. So
one of the Kettle Valley pictures is in the show we're discussing, Kettle Valley number 29 from 1999. It's a cut picture.
Yeah.
And it shows kind of an area that's been cleared for railroad, and it's kind of shale that's maybe even been eroded since it was cut over 100 years ago.
Yeah, and you might note that the bed of that in that picture is fairly smooth. I actually drove through there.
It's very smooth.
Yeah.
It looks like a road for cars, not something being prepared as a road for trains.
Yeah. I see, you know, in terms of, you know, what happened to these lines that are now defunct, because I did not photograph operating railroad lines. I photographed only those that had been abandoned different points. You know, some of them are used for car traffic. Some of them are just, you know, very rugged four-wheel drive tracks. Some are almost like, you know, two-lane highways. Some of them are impassable, even on foot. So it sort of depends on subsequent uses of the land and ownership and everything else. And people often ask about what happened to the rails when they look at my pictures. And with a few exceptions, because when I amassed a certain number of pictures, I thought it would be okay to kind of have a little bit of that stuff. But I was most interested when I first showed these pictures to friends and colleagues that there was a kind of ambiguity as to whether or not they were natural formations or, in fact, earthwork. And as soon as we see the rails, I mean, that riddle is answered, but I really enjoyed that kind of ambiguity of, you know, where's the agency here? You know, how was this landscape, this landform created? But people want to know what happened to the rails, depending on when the line was abandoned. They would have been, you know, torn up either during World War I or World War II, metal drives, basically. The wooden ties, they become somebody's fence posts or firewood, or they're still there, or they are ultimately buried under the dirt that's on the surface now. Sometimes you'd be walking a road, it's like a trail in the woods, and all of a sudden you notice that there's a railroad tie just sort of like this little bump in the road, you know.
Let's talk for a moment about San Diego and Arizona Eastern number 7 from 2003. It's a photograph Brian Scholes referenced earlier in the show. It's an astonishing picture in about 10 ways.
Thank you.
First, could you tell us, it shows a trestle bridge, a very particular, beautiful, dramatic bridge. First, maybe could you tell us how you found it?
Yeah, that's actually a kind of funny story, too. I showed some pictures to the people at the, you know, I don't remember the exact title, the Museum of Photography in San Diego. I was talking to the young assistant there, to the curator. He said something, you know, do you know where Goat Canyon is? You might really like Goat Canyon. So I said, okay, you know, but I, you know, so I looked on my road atlas, and Goat Canyon had some, you know, it was obviously a site along this railroad line, which I'd never photographed. But he didn't say what was there, you know? And so I found my way out there. You drive a couple miles on a sandy track through the Anza-Borrego Desert till you can't drive anymore, and you get up on the railroad bed and start walking. And because I didn't know what I was looking for, I just walked until I got really, well, I thought I'd walk until I was tired or bored. And because it was a difficult walk, because unlike most of the other railroads, the track is still there, and that's, you know, after a couple miles, that stuff's really hard to walk on. But the landscape was so spectacular, I just kept going, and I finally came around this bend, and there was that bridge. Essentially, the view as we actually what we're seeing is I walked across and shot it from the opposite end, but it's, you know, kind of mirror image of the picture. I was, you know, I came around the bend and saw this thing. And I was just sort of so bowled over, you know, because it's the woods creosoted, so it's almost black, and it's, you know, this kind of bleached, rocky landscape. The scale of that whole landscape is so huge that it takes a minute to realize how big the trestle is, you know. Weirdly, the whole trestle was covered with mountain bikers in purple and black spandex, so I had to wait them out, but they were just having, and they had come up from the opposite direction. That's why I thought I was, you know, alone in the wilderness. And but you never really are in California. So if you look in the top left of that picture, above the trestle, there's this, what looks like a little black Lawson shape. That's actually a full-size railroad tanker car that's been been put up there for, as a, you know, source of water. That's why it's up high, you know. And that, when you, once you recognize that object, that the scale of that landscape snaps into place in a really interesting way, you know, because it's just, I've since heard a few things. It's the San Diego and Arizona Eastern, and apparently every once in a while some San Diego politician makes some noise about reopening that line. And
good Lord.
Yeah, which is, you know, you look at it, it's just, again, it's completely crazy. Apparently is the world's largest all wood curved railroad trestle, and it's sort of sitting out there, the most amazing thing. But it's so, you know, you really have to make a lot of effort to go see it. And, you know, carrying a big camera in that kind of, you know, even if it's not that hot, it's so dry that you know, of course, you're also carrying water and stuff. So it's a chore.
One of the things that Brian told me about the picture is that eventually you came to see Courbet's famous painting, Vision of the World.
I just wanted to skip that part. yeah, I mean, it's, you know, of course, a lot of. I mean, it's very obviously sort of, you know, reminds a lot of viewers of a woman's pubic area, of course. I mean, I swear I was not thinking of those things when I made the pictures, you know. in fact, I made, you know, I don't know what the best picture is, and sometimes, you know, I have this idea of, with my work in general, that I'm not that interested in making something that's really clever, so I try to make a kind of dumb or mute picture, you know, or just sort of level the camera at eye level and sort of stand at a certain distance, and, you know, I make this exposure, and I think, well, I'm done, but then I feel like, well, I worked so hard to get here, I should do some other stuff just in case, you know. So I, you know, something like that. I would, you know, made some pictures from where I first saw it, and then, you know, I actually climbed off of the trestle into the upper reach of the canyon and photographed it looking down, and then went on the other side. And I think actually, unlike what is usually the case, it was the last exposure that was the keeper, but I wasn't thinking of women.
It's an amazing dramatic picture. We'll certainly have it on Modern Art Notes and on manpodcast.com. Last question. You mentioned Lewis Baltz and Robert Adams earlier.
Yeah.
And a lot of critical response to your work, or at least to this series, tends to reference the new topographics photographers. I'm not sure I totally maybe buy all of that critical analysis, but certainly Baltz.
Yeah.
I really do understand the Lewis Baltz one. Maybe you could tell us what you take from Baltz, or what you took from Baltz.
You know, originally, you know, again, I started making landscape photographs. I previously, when I began photography seriously, I photographed people and places, sort of urban landscape, and I guess stuff sort of more social landscape stuff. But when I left my home base to go to graduate school, and which was my first sort of, I didn't study photography as an undergraduate. I was a painting major, actually. And so I became a convert, and, you know, they're the most zealous, of course.
We should add, you went to graduate school in Montreal.
That's correct, at Concordia. And I chose that mostly because I photographed outside, and I thought Montreal is a really interesting place, you know. So, you know, and I thought, I got to be in an interesting place if I'm going to make pictures. So people started, when they looked at the work I started making there somewhat naively, they started talking about topographics and that. And I wasn't really familiar with that. I mean, I'd seen some of those pictures, but I hadn't really thought about it in any critical way, and I didn't understand the sort of theoretical underpinnings of either the practitioners or those their explainers, if you will. But I started, of course, you know, paying close attention to that work, and I think you know, this has survived for me. Balts and Adams in different ways represented something for me that it was both really exciting and interesting, but also maybe useful. And, you know, it's a bit hard to sort all that stuff out, but I think originally, or early on anyway, what they represented to me was this notion that landscape, as an idiom or a genre or whatever else you want to call it, was not, you know, this kind of used up cliche ridden, nowheresville. Rather, mm-hmm. what their work suggested to me that landscape photography could be an arena which one could make, you know, inquiry into the social and the cultural. That was sort of really important to me when I sort of was able to articulate that to myself. Balts, of all the new photographers, he's certainly the most radical. And I think part of what's most significant for me, where his work stands out, at least his work of that period, is the kind of insistence on the individual photograph just being a kind of unit. And then, in fact, it's the series, the body of work presented in a kind of, you know, very extremely controlled and articulated manner that is the engine of meaning making, if you will. All those other photographers, by comparison, are much more conventional, and that's, you know, nothing wrong with that, but I think that's something that I learned from Balz's work that I don't think is in the other work. And I think it's, you know, maybe that appealed to me somewhat because, like Balz, I didn't study photography, you know, not in a kind of conventional way, and you know, Balz was certainly as interested in you know, other contemporary art of his time as I was. You know, for Balz, maybe the, you know, the minimalists, and, you know, or Mallory Baden's sculpture, any number of things that would distinguish him from, say, Robert Adams' love of Ansel Adams. You know, I don't know what this means, but I, as a young person trying to figure out how to be an artist and what kind of artist to be, I knew more about Robert Smithson than I did about Walker Evans. You know, because that
Balz did too.
Probably, yeah. But in fact, you know, Walker Evans is one of the most important photographers to me of all time. You know, I didn't come to that stuff very, you know, early. I sort of, my education has been out of sequence, if you will. but I actually did part of my master's thesis on Walker Evans photographs of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, because they're such great iconic pictures, but also because I grew up there.
Well, Mark Riddell, thanks so much for being on the Modern Art Notes podcast, and thanks so much for the pictures.
Oh, it's been a pleasure talking about it. Thank you, Todd.
That's all for this week's show. Special thanks to Steve Roden, who created the sound for the program. The Modern Art Notes podcast is released under a Creative Commons license. For more information, please see modernartnotes or manpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.